This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Chi. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Pretty well, considering.
Oh.
Yeah, I suppose that's
this
a fair
makes
answer.
Me feel like there's going to be some ranting today.
We're in a mood.
Yeah. How are things with you, Nathan?
They're good. It's, you know, it's getting a little bit of colder weather here. We're actually in the middle of a rainstorm here in Southern mm-hmm. California. I got a little flash flood warning by the government, and it said, and I'm going to pull it up here just to read it because my libertarian.
Do you need a vaccine for
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, what's interesting is now you drive on the freeways and they have the billboard saying, get your vaccine, get your booster, go to whatever the website is to do it.
Yeah.
Every state, when I was on my road trip a couple of months ago, you would see that almost every state, including pretty red states. It's like a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know who's controlling those. Because I know when I drove through Arizona, they had some really comical ones about speed. Like there was some poet or comic like controlling those things. They had some really funny ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, but not anymore. But the flash flood
always
warning.
Makes me, yeah.
Yeah, the flash flood warning I got was saying, don't attempt to travel unless you are fleeing an area subject to flooding. And my first thought was, don't tell me what to do, government. Stop it. I'll take my own risks. But I've still been here at home stuck. So
there we go.
Oh, God. Right. This is the danger of institutional failure is that when people stop trusting their institutions, things get a little nasty and you can actually find yourself at increased risk in something like a flash flood. Yeah. Seattle got a push notification to all of our phones last week that the 911 system was down, mm-hmm. speaking of government assistance.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, yeah, if you've got an emergency, just go ahead and call this alternative number. So hopefully people in need got the text and you know, remembered to act on it. It was several hours that it was down for some sort of infrastructural issue. So,
Is that the city that defunded the police? Then they got a whole bunch of crime. Then they realized they have to refund the police.
Yeah.
Yeah. The empirics on that escape me somewhat because it's certainly a talking point, but I'm not sure that they actually were meaningfully defunded, but definitely there have been some shakeups with staffing, with mandates, et cetera. So they've lost some of their boys in blue, their boys and girls in blue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this sounds like a little foreshadowing of what's to come, but I can assure the listeners we're going to actually get some questions first, and then we're going to let Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle speak about some current events. So as soon as we're done with the questions, we'll let everybody know. For the ones who just who want to hear more, they can turn it up.
Sure. All right. What's up, Nathan?
All right. Our first question. Dear doctors, how would you actually raise a child? More specifically, the first year, all that whining and crying and getting barely any sleep for the first year. Is there anything parents can actually do? Or if there's nothing, if someone has the finances to, would you actually recommend hiring a nanny or somebody similar?
I guess my first thought is
to sleep.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about raising an infant. So, and I think that there's pretty large individual differences in infants and how they act. So, but I think one of the only underlying question that I'm hearing that we can probably meaningfully answer is the idea of if you could afford help, is it wise or good for the child's development to be raised by somebody else in their first year, or is this a potential mistake because of bonding and the infant experience, et cetera. And I can rest assured it doesn't make a damn bit of difference who's raising that kid. So obviously, if you're going to be the parent, even if you have a nanny or you have help, you're going to be plenty attached, overwhelmingly invested. So there's going to be no lack of attachment on your part. And basically cleaning up after them and having them wreck your sleep for a year or two isn't going to help you love them more. The point of all this is an underlying psychodynamic theory of a parent-child, particularly mother-child attachment in early childhood being this immensely important issue in personality development or the relationship development is 100% nonsense. And, understandable nonsense. It's understandable that people are thinking that the early years of life are real, real tender and impressionable. And that if we bend them or push them or break little things, then they permanently disabled the organism. That is not true. And that was a hypothesis that was, obviously considered for thousands of years, throughout history, and has been found to be false. And so we can dismiss it. And for God's sake, if you can afford it, get as much help as you can afford. That's my official recommendation.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely up against all of the conventional wisdom out there from the whole parenting industry and the psychodynamic industries and where they intersect. So I remember, I was very, not as a parent, but as somebody trying to make sense of the issues and problems in my life, it's very attractive to look at sort of narratives and explanations of things gone wrong in development because of caregiver errors, right? So it's I particularly got excited about Gabor Mate, who lots of people who are listening might be familiar. He's written several books, When the Body Says No and In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. He's sort of an addiction specialist who works with people on Skid Row in Vancouver. And he's got this very trauma-centered worldview of, all addiction stems from early trauma, essentially, and disconnection. And this is not an uncommon worldview. And so I trying to make sense of my own struggles and my father's struggles and family struggles with addiction, kind of came across this work and was totally riveted by this explanation that he gives in the book, which is basically, if you don't sufficiently bond with a central caregiver early on in exactly the right way, because you don't make the right kind of eye contact, because maybe your caregiver is distracted, or maybe they're high themselves, or whatever it is, that your little brain is not going to develop all of the right little connections that it's supposed to, and so therefore you're going to struggle with addiction as you grow up. And I was like, oh my God, this explains everything. this is all my dad's fault. This is why this happened. And it's very attractive. It's a really convenient way to relocate all of your personal responsibility onto these things that supposedly happened in the past. But this is just pattern finding. So, it would be just as easy to say, oh, well, I have escapist tendencies because my parents were too attentive and smothered me. It's like, it's just whatever you were dealing with, you look to that as some source of explanation of why things are not as you would wish them to be as an adult. And there's always some degree of imperfection or something that you can find fault with. And then there are psychodynamic practitioners very willing to sell you that idea. So that's where all of this comes from. And it's unfortunately, as with most things, completely at odds with reality. So yes, get your sleep.
Yeah, there you go.
And of course, you can get it back with 60 sessions, right? With a psychodynamic therapist.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. What else we got, Nathan?
Our next question. Dear doctors, do obese people have differing psychologies? I would assume that obese genes wouldn't survive to reproduce in historic times before agriculture in terms of extreme obesity. So do you think that has any impact upon psychology today? Also, are there any groups of people that have differing psychology from the average human population for reasons similar to the question, or just at all?
this questioner is trying really hard, and they're trying to use some ideas that they've heard here, and they're trying to make sense of some things. So we can applaud the effort, like a bright student in the class trying to ask a question that's a little bit past them. So there weren't any obese people in Stone Age environments, and there weren't any obese people or extreme obese people. The genes for obesity are simply genes that are more thrifty in terms of conserving energy. And so those people would have been in Stone Age environments. Even somebody with that today is extremely obese, all you're looking at is a completely functional human genotype that in the Stone Age environment would have been moderately thick. Okay. So,
and would have had a survival and reproductive advantage.
Absolutely.
Like a very significant advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question is sort of framed backwards.
Right. Right. So that they're just kind of confused about what they're seeing in the modern environment. So yeah, so there's no, so they're kind of upside down there. So the, secondly, when it comes to they're kind of also reaching to try to figure out, are there groups of people somehow that are different than other groups of people? Well, it depends on how you group them. Then there's an infinite variety of ways to group people, right down to the level of a single gene variation. But that's silliness. So, but there are meaningful differences in how people are sort of personality-wise and physically, depending upon where on the globe the parents met. In other words, two people from central France that ancestors came from central France, and we looked at their genes and we can see that they've been in central France for thousands of years. Those people look different and are going to act somewhat differently on average than people that are from Scotland. So even just a few hundred miles away in evolution can make non-trivial differences in behavioral characteristics and in physical characteristics. And so so certainly when we get out to the level of continents, we see very significant differences in people. So a continental view of, or even subcontinents, Northern Asians versus Southern Asians, Africans, Eastern Africans versus Western Africans. Different, Northern Europeans, Southern Europeans. These can be sliced up, if you would like to, into different groups of essentially groups of people. And then if you tested them on various characteristics, both physically and in personality, you would find group averages. And the further away those people are likely to be in terms of evolutionary time, the more different they are likely to be, or added in, of course, the adaptive landscape. So Eastern Africans, for example, evolved in very different circumstances than Irish. And as a result, I would expect that if we looked at 100 Eastern Africans and 100 Irish, and we took mean differences, we're going to see all kinds of significant differences on the bell curves of each population as plotted against the Big Five or other measures. So in that way, this was beautifully documented and argued by Nicholas Wade, who did his most famous essay, was where he brought the house down on the gain of function research of COVID-19.
Right. All right. Right. So, the Atomic Bulletin. Yeah.
The Atomic Bulletin.
Former New York Times, long time journalist and researcher, author, really well known and respected.
Yeah.
Wrote this hell of a book.
Yeah, hell of a book called A Troublesome Inheritance. And so for those that are interested in this type of question, we would direct you there. Nicholas Wade is a superb read, just a fine scholar, and you'll get a feel for these sort of group differences around the Earth.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's amazing that the same guy who wrote about these ideas of the genes, race, human history, all these things, now did the research on the political side of things. So for listeners who are always upset about the, you know, the stuff that you guys share, just realize it's coming from the same sources. The same brains are finding
it's not
these
our
things.
Fault. It's Nicholas. Yeah, it's Nicholas Wade's fault. And it's totally not our Nicholas fault. Wade's he's fault. Convincing.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Nathan.
The 10,000-year explosion covers some of the same territory as well, from a slightly more cynical point of view. So, but it's for people who are really interested. You can deep dive into that too.
What was that again, Dr. Hawk?
It's a book called The 10,000-Year Explosion, about recent evolution and divergence, by Gregory Cochrane and his co-author, whose name is currently escaping me.
Okay, cool.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
All right, what else we got, Nathan?
All right, dear doctors, I have a question about sleep. Is it genetics, how much sleep someone needs? Do some people just naturally need more sleep, even when diet and exercise and stress level and everything is in the right place? Do introverts need more sleep and rest because their nervous system works differently?
I don't know anything about introverts versus extroverts, but certainly, and certainly the condition of the organism makes a difference. So if you're sick, if you're injured, you know, et cetera, if you've been stressed, all those things would make a difference in terms of your sleep needs. But all things being equal, genes have an enormous impact on the individual differences. So yeah, sleep, that is going to be the main variable in individual differences in the amount of need for sleep, without a doubt.
And you know, sleep differences beyond like the quantity of sleep, but also your sleep preferences, early birds versus night owls,
right.
You know, all this kind of stuff. I wouldn't expect there to be a really consistent difference between introverts needing more sleep than extroverts. I can see the intuition for that, i.e. introverts get their battery drained being out there with people and need to recharge. But, you
if
know,
anything,
I,
extroverts
I,
should need more
I
sleep.
I think
then,
that's...
Right?
Yeah, and I think that's just a little egocentric bias from the questioner, who's probably an introvert who restores their energy through sleep. But I don't think you would see that widespread across the population. So I've certainly known lots of insomniac introverts myself. So.
I would completely I completely agree. I'd be surprised to find any effect there.
Dr. Lyle,
I would not believe it if I saw it.
Yeah, they're just very separate. Yeah, just separate circuits, basically.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle, I remember a long time ago, I had heard you make a comment in a lecture at True North, which is that there was some belief that introverts may have something in their immune system that makes them less likely to want to interact with people. Maybe I'm misquoting that, but could you?
No, that's correct.
Okay.
No, that's correct. In other words, that's a very significant hypothesis that has non-trivial support. That introverts may essentially be reacting to some surveillance mechanism of the immune system that knows that they are better off not challenging that immune system. So that is that's by way of Jeffrey Miller, and it's interesting. That doesn't mean that that's still not ultimately genetic in origin. Okay, so just as the robustness of a person's musculature is going to be genetic largely, so could be the robustness of an immune system. So I don't, you know what, that's getting a little deep and complicated and too much uncertainty for us to really be speaking about, because I don't want anybody thinking that anybody really knows anything with any certainty. But that is a legitimate hypothesis in evolutionary theory, and and there's evidence suggesting that it may well have, you know, it doesn't have to be the big story in introversion, but it may be a significant part of the story.
Well, I don't know if he came up with this theory before or after he hooked up with his current wife. But when I first heard the question, it actually made me think of her work, which is about disgust primarily, and disgust being higher among women and higher during particularly susceptible points in the menstrual cycle, especially the luteal phase when you're more susceptible to infection, and just, you know, higher levels of aversion and disgust among women in general. And she also has written about illness. And when we are sick, we become introverts. We become much more introverted. Obviously, everyone's had this experience. You want to crawl into a hole and be left alone. You don't want to be going out and socializing. And you certainly don't want to be around people that you don't know. And she's written quite a bit, I think did quite a bit of her doctoral work in that area. So I don't know if they intersected on that sort of coincidentally, or if he picked that up from her.
I'm sure he picked that up from her. That sounds directly derivative. Yeah.
She actually wrote an essay fairly recently that was very good about this issue, about how personality can change quite profoundly in response to chronic illness.
Yeah.
Introversion being one of those kind of shifts that people can undergo.
And just to keep people clear in our consistency, the personality didn't change. The circumstances changed, and therefore the person's behavioral pattern changes, i.e. what the outside would call personality, but we would call a change in your circumstances. So,
but it can change in a consistent way if your environment changes consistently.
Right.
So if you are stricken by a chronic illness that is lifelong, then the shift in your that intersection between your innate personality and the environment is consistent as well. Mm-hmm. So your whole personality as it is expressed moves to a new equilibrium. So
Exactly. Unless you get lucky and you water fast and you get better and then you get to bounce back.
Right.
But I mean, that is precisely right.
Yeah.
And I've seen that in people that have suffered from, you know, chronic fatigue, for example, and have not been able to get better. Those personalities are effectively changed because circumstances have changed basically permanently for the worse.
Yep.
Yep. All right. What else we got, Nathan?
All right. Dear doctors, this question is about disagreeable distance. I have been working on that with my family members who are very difficult, unpleasant, and disrespectful towards me. While it does help considerably with the day-to-day dynamics, I often still feel guilty about pulling away and think that I need to explain myself to everyone even though I haven't. I'm very high conscientious and agreeable on the Big Five, and in the 90s for both. I do believe I am doing the right thing in limiting contact and resources for my happiness and well-being, but I don't feel better. Why won't my inner critic give me esteem for separating myself from the disagreeables?
The problem is that you're in conflict over the resource management of the hit that your reputation takes with your tribe from withdrawing from them. And so you're used to, you've got anxiety about being having your resource points of resource in the tribe basically contracting and you losing esteem with them and therefore putting yourself in a more vulnerable position. So the fact that we have an alternative analysis of their value and that it encouraged you to actually make this move, all this means is that you've got cognitive dissonance over whether it's worth it. And the so I would say that There are a number of things that could possibly shift your cognitive dissonance. One of those, for example, one of them is just more time with the process. So that's one thing. Second of all, you might benefit from an independent third party analysis of the CB as someone essentially helps walk you through what your vulnerabilities are relative to a reduced tribe, particularly that tribe, which it doesn't sound like a particularly useful tribe, and what it is that you may need to do to move your mind into a position of power with respect to those new vulnerabilities that are coming from getting the disagreeable distance. So this is... I would say that's, you know, somebody needs to, you might use a third party that could be very thoughtful in helping walk you through sort of what your adaptive unconscious is concerned about and get you more to a position of power about those things. So the therapists like this are a dime a dozen on every corner that can do this kind of really simple work, but you better just find the only one that can do it. You talk to Jen Hawk.
Well, and even if you don't, even if we don't have a session, I don't know if this questionnaire is in either of my weekly groups, but this is a very kind of common situation in the two weekly groups that I do. And so I can give you a reality check, but so can the other people in the group. So,
right.
And I've seen that happen with this exact issue because there is great selection bias in my groups, especially my women's group for high C, high agreeable people in the sucker triad, essentially. And so a lot of people who have cut ties with disagreeables, whether they're family members or friends or whoever they are, and they have this residual kind of conflict and guilt about it. It's a super common issue. So yeah, come on over to the virtual village and we'll we'll check you.
Yeah, perfect. That's just perfect. Great. All right, Nathan, now what do we
all
got?
All right. Dear doctors, I know you try to avoid talking politics. I don't know what they're talking about.
They're not listening to us.
Or discussing very briefly, but maybe you can give us an evolutionary perspective on today's hot topic. This question was submitted a few weeks ago, but this hot topic about an anti-abortion law in Texas. Question is why is there such heated fight over a woman's decision to have or not have a child? Most actions to enforce anti-abortion laws are taken by male politicians. What is it to them if someone's offspring appears on the planet Earth against their mother's wish? Many claim the religious reason, but it seems to be only on the surface, as it looks like many politicians don't give a damn to Christian values if they do not serve their purpose. What is their true motivation? What is the evolutionary perspective on all of these fights?
Well, I'll speak on this, and then Jen can find, you know, the holes in my thinking. But the first of all, any individual politician's thinking is likely to be not very well analyzable, because politicians by nature are actors, and they're attempting to build the largest possible coalitions for their own personal interests. So it's difficult to know what they really think about anything, okay? So now the question is, however, the people that vote for them are not doing that same thing. People that vote for them are voting for their positions that they truly believe in. So we can skip over what the individual politicians are up to. And the fact that it's male politicians voting for this, the vast majority of politicians are male, so that's not a relevant issue here, okay? When it comes to pro-choice, pro-life, this is basically evenly divided, and it is not the case that statistically that there's a statistical difference in the gender breakdowns of these things. Just as high a percentage of women are pro-life as are men. Okay, in other words, there is not a gender bias in this decision. So the so now the question becomes, from this questioner's perspective, somebody else might have a 180-degree different perspective and ask the same question. But the question is, why is it, you know, why do people have this desire to say, hey, you know, a woman can't do this? And we find this really interesting problem, and that is that people have individual differences in their perspective about what's fair. So there are people, I can remember, I actually remember having a little lightning bolt in my life when I was about, you know, 19 or 20. Now that would have been about 21, 22, because it was when Alan Goldhammer was in grad school. And he called me up, and I don't got, so this is amazing because of the million hours of conversations that we had, this is a moment in the conversation that I remember to this day. So yeah, this question now brings it up. So we're going back four decades, and my brain is like a memory device. It's like I've got an audio tape recording. As Alan said, well, it is ridiculous. Life does begin at conception, Deck. It's like, whoa.
Wow.
Okay. So, and he, you know, he had been studying the biology and, you know, he was deep in grad school and he's looking at the whole thing, what pregnancy is. And Alan is, if anything, utterly unemotional human. Okay. So it's not like he was brought up with any big political agenda on any side of anything, or religious for that matter. He was just looking at it as a dispassionate, you know, young doctor looking at the scientific evidence saying, hey, it begins a conception, for God's sake. What the hell else are you going to call it? Okay. And so that did not make him in any way, pro-life. But that was his position. And quite frankly, that people can defend that position all day long. And so now the question is, well, what point does this thing start to have inalienable rights? Okay, it's like, well, you tell me. So you start to realize that this whole damn thing winds up being a muddy continuum. And so now you can see how, and it was useful for me to have that conversation. I don't remember if I was hot under the collar about it. I don't think I was. I think I was more kind of surprised. Like, I never even considered it from that perspective. And so you live long enough and you're going to run into people who are very bright, very sincere, and absolutely believe that aborting a fetus is killing a child. And there's no way for them to see it any differently. On the other hand, in a remarkable turn of personal psychology, Senator Orrin Hatch out of Utah looked at this question as a United States senator and having to weigh in on judicial decisions and everything else. And there was a very amazing quote of a personal statement he made that he said, you know, I've looked at all the evidence and I have examined my conscience from every possible angle. And I cannot look at a fertilized egg and say that that is a human. And I cannot support blocking a woman's, you know, right to choose or whatever. This is a deeply religious man who looks at it upside down, inside out, examines his own conscience, and comes to the conclusion that I would come to. Okay? And fought his way there through a deep examination of the evidence as best he could. Now, someone, you know, 2% different genetically from Orrin Hatch, you know, very similar, can't make that leap and doesn't, and winds up in the on the other side of this. So what I'm telling you is the great question of, quote, how the hell can they think the way they're thinking? When you are thinking that way, it's because you don't have enough life experience and you haven't talked to enough variety of people that differ in their opinions to you. You haven't talked to enough of them. You may have talked to, argued with 15 ones that didn't impress you, but you didn't actually discuss dispassionately or calmly with 15 people that you respect the hell out of that think differently than you do. And when you do, then you'll understand why this is one of the great debates of our age, because people, well-meaning people that are highly capable, forget that 90% of the unwashed masses who can't string three sentences together that aren't contradictory. Forget about all those people. I'm talking about people that should have the decisions of a culture in their hands. Those people legitimately can differ in their opinions, and that's what makes this very difficult. That's how I see it. So I respect that this is an extremely difficult problem. Myself personally, without any question, I'm pro-choice. But I recognize that a reason for that isn't because I'm smarter and I've thought it through more deeply than somebody equally bright on the other side of this question. It's because they and myself, through either personal experiences or differences in genetics, literally have our brains grind their way to a different opinion. And, you know, that's why you have a Supreme Court and you have judicial challenges and you have new evidence that can come in over the ages. And a society does the very best they can when they are deeply conflicted. And that's what I have to say about it. Jen, what do you think about this?
No, I mean, I think that's a very comprehensive overview. The only thing I can think to kind of chime in with is that that coming to that well-considered, conclusion, that process can include various distortions of various types, including strong, powerful religious conviction. So, you know, that is going to play into the analysis of a lot of people. It's not necessarily, I mean, obviously we know that there are a lot of people who have these knee-jerk sweeping reactions to these sorts of political questions. And mm-hmm. We're not talking about those people. We are talking about these people who have strongly considered it and weighed the pros and cons. And so there are some who are, you know, under the influence of their religious conviction and their strong religious beliefs, that is when life begins, and they believe that for different reasons than Alan Goldhammer believes it.
Right.
And then there are others who, and I have seen plenty of these in my political years working in legislatures and with committees and running campaigns, that it's very which way is the wind blowing in this district.
Yeah.
You know, which it's very, their personal beliefs may not at all reflect their political beliefs, that they are really coalition building in their district, and they are pandering and they are flip-flopping and everything else. And so there's a huge, huge piece of that in this as well. So part of what makes it frustrating to watch as a spectator of the politics is that there is a lot of just general hypocrisy to the whole question, and people pick up on that. Like you're watching people talk out of both sides of their mouth, and you can't quite catch them doing it, and it's very frustrating. So that's in there too.
Yeah, you bet. All right,
thank you.
Got anything else, Nathan?
Yeah, we got one more question, and then we get to hear
hear
you guys.
Thank God.
All right. Dear doctors, I'd like to hear your thoughts on people having paranoia. In the internet, you hear all kinds of reasons for why people have paranoid thoughts. Is it mainly genetics and personality? Can you treat paranoia? And if so, how?
Well, some of us develop it situationally.
Beautiful segue for what's coming.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
How do we begin this? Our deepest apologies in respect to Pam Popper. This is very germane to where we're going.
It is.
I would say, first of all, paranoia, that's a sweeping word that encompasses a wide range of mental processes. So I think that we would have to define it, and we'd have to define it as a repetitive pattern of arriving at inferences, feelings, and then probably related behavior associated with an irrational suspicion that other people are out to do one harm. Okay, so that characteristic could be true of someone, for example, coming down off of a meth high, or someone that just smoked some really particularly potent weed can get paranoid. In other words, we can alter the brain chemistry and get people paranoid. We can also have patterns of behavior that are suspicious-looking coincidences that fall together and make it look like there's something nefarious aimed at you. But I don't think that's what we generally are talking about when we're talking about paranoia. We're talking about someone who is not under the influence, but has a sort of a steady, bizarre inferences of being, you know, of essentially being a target. That is going to be genetic. So obviously it could happen. You could have, i.e., drug damage, brain damage, car accident. You could have things that could jar a system and damage the brain's ability to make reasonable inferences. But the main reason why it is that you're going to see, quote, what we're going to broadly call paranoid experience inside of people, paranoid personality disorder, paranoid schizophrenia, whatever you want to call it, paranoid this, paranoid that, it's all the same thing. All of it is due to gene variation. And so that is the reason. And so it's a naturally varying characteristic, as you would expect, that in a Stone Age environment, in a group living, you should have a certain amount of neural circuits in there that are monitoring situations, looking for evidence that others could be plotting against you. And so,
overestimating the worst case scenario. Like that's a very adaptive skill that a lot of people with just generally high conscientiousness have. And then you add in a little instability.
Yeah.
you get some what we might call paranoia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not maladaptive per se. It's helpful. But it's all depends on the context.
Right. And if you get a little too wide and a little too open and not very smart, you wind up with some really stupid shit. And mm-hmm. and then you can get some really destructive behavior in response to those anxieties.
Like aliens, so, maybe? Dr. Lyle.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I mean, I have, of course, treated many people. And the question is there any treatment? And the answer is no, there's no really treatment. As Robert Plumman would say, there's no disease, so there's no cure. The best you can do is to try to provide a little bit of coalition support for the person so they feel generally a little bit less anxious in life. And hopefully, you know, that's enough to make them a little bit more comfortable. So that's that. Yeah, don't believe me. Don't bring out the Stelazine, you know, Dr. Mm-hmm. Genius psychiatrist and think that you're going to help this, because you will not. All right.
All right. Let's, wonderful. Dr. Lau, Dr. Hawk. What else do you guys have on your minds?
Do we have a little bit more time, or what do we think?
I think we have a little more time.
We should run a little bit. You know, just here we sit. You know, here we sit at a kind of an interesting position that we have on board in our little esteemed dynamics, Beat Your Genes world. A PhD Harvard political scientist in the, this is like that famous phrase from Patton, from the movie Patton, like when they put him on the sidelines to take away his command, and then the whole world is at war, and he says, "The whole world's at war, and I'm not in it." The whole world is in a political, unbelievable shitstorm. Unlike anything since World War II. And we have a resident political scientist. And so what the heck, what are you thinking, feeling, sensing, anticipating? Just tell us a few things about what's in the mind of Jen Hawk these days.
Oh, I'm getting all set up for like this high quality rant, and really just like my brain is broken. It's like this week has just broken me. I just feel like I have spent so much of my interest in politics and political science was motivated by the study of authoritarian and totalitarian regimes and how they consolidated power and how they managed internal enemies and how they created. I mean, one of the very first papers I wrote once I decided to major in political science was about the value of a perpetual crisis in an authoritarian regime, and like how that was like this really essential thing. You've got to have a perpetual crisis so you can continue to generate internal enemies, so you can continue to legitimize your tyranny, essentially. And so this was poli-sci 101, and I was always very interested in these themes and pursued them up through. I mean, I originally went to graduate school to study post-Soviet institutions across the Soviet space, including in Cuba and not so much China. I was never a China specialist. But very interested in Soviet institutions, especially in Soviet history, and propaganda and censorship and all of these things that I just am sitting here watching this unfold in the West in a way that makes me feel that, you know, maybe we never did win the Cold War. Maybe it's all been a very long game. I'm just baffled and broken and disheartened and just cannot believe what we are watching. And as Doug keeps reminding me, every time I start to bitch about this, he's like, "You keep forgetting we're at war. This is war. Like, this is not a rational process." I keep beating my head against the wall. Like, why aren't people seeing it? Why aren't people, looking at the high concepts here, the high principles of Western civilization and fighting for them? But it's war. It's absolutely war. And we talked about this a little bit on our Q&A, the Living Wisdom Library Q&A last week, where people have been asking us about this predominant theory that a lot of very smart people have embraced, this mass psychosis theory, that you have mass populations of humans under some kind of hypnotic spell as a feature of, I don't know, the destruction of their culture and meaning and these certain things that have been put into place in various points in history, including in Nazi Germany and of course now. And we discussed kind of, you know, why we didn't think that was exactly what was going on, that this is more the aggregation of individual interests and people acting very much on an individual level out of immediate self-interest. But some of that self-interest is going along with the crowd and going along with the crowd in a way that forces people to embrace a new worldview that is coherent to them and a cohesive narrative of what is happening and what is right. And that is just that narrative and that worldview is one that seems to be inevitably hurtling us toward a sort of bio-authoritarianism. I don't see how we stop it at this point, and I just find it very dismaying. So that's where I'm at. I'm depressed AF. How are you doing?
Yeah. Well, I'm less depressed. These are individual differences between us. So people, just FYI, this is something that Jen sent me today. Twitter is now going to be banishing people who quote science that shows that people that are vaccinated can pass the virus. Now, let's get very clear about this. There is no scientific question at all about this. Of course, people that are vaccinated can pass the virus. They pass it just as well as people that are unvaccinated. However, this is absolutely deeply and evilly motivated by Twitter. And Twitter is, of course, part of a massive Western capital that goes along with Microsoft and Apple and Facebook, Amazon and Google, okay, and Pfizer. And so, by the way, it occurred to me that Pfizer rhymes with Kaiser.
Oh, God. Sure does. Well, there have been many, many, many fascism jokes out there. Yeah. the fascist regime.
Yeah. So... Yeah. This is no joke. We're not hallucinating, and we're not making something up, and we're not blowing something up bigger than it is, and we're not making a mountain out of a molehill. The foundation of what we understand to be freedom is under vicious and ruthless assault by major Western capital, and these individuals have gotten so wealthy that they've literally figured out a new way of taking over the world. So the cost of warfare has been dropped by 99%. So now all the warfare, it's a brilliant scheme that you don't have to actually shoot people to death and then put them, throw them in the river and destroy their tanks. That's old fashioned, quaint and stupid. All you have to do is take over the existing government machinery, quote, quasi-legally. And you take over the press, you buy it, and then you basically have your company called Twitter ban anybody that says what is obviously true, so the public literally can be confused and actually miseducated about what the truth is, and et cetera. And then by that you justify the extraordinary process that you're seeing now worldwide, where you're going to have to be vaccinated in Germany and in Austria, and if you aren't vaccinated, they're going to fine you 4,000 euros a month in Austria, and you're not going to be able to work. Essentially, what you're doing is you're looking at theft. Okay, so you're looking at regimes stealing people's life savings and their livelihoods. You're watching something that is a different version of devastating a society with carpet bombing in its individual level. Yeah, in other words, they're able to pick out who they want to kill effectively. And so this is, it's also, Jen sent me, you sent me an extraordinary essay that really explains some things that I hadn't quite conceptualized in my own head. which is the notion that it's the first time ever that you sort of that the cabal doesn't have national boundaries or alliances. It's a different looking animal. It was the Chinese and the Americans put together the coronavirus. That's who did it. They're supposed to be enemies, but they work together on it, for God's sakes. And so you're finding that the reach of all these things is bizarrely international, and you're watching the leadership of countries do completely and utterly irrational things that are leading to pressure and financial penalties for those who don't go along with the regime. This is amazing. And
he called it a self-inflicted genocide, essentially.
Yes, self-inflicted.
Yeah, and
amazingly enough, through this, quote, mass psychosis, which is not what it is, we analyzed this on the Living Wisdom Library.
It is what it is, but yes. We shouldn't call it by that name or use that framework. But it is a mob mentality, sort of, you know, it goes by many, many names, moral panic. You know, there are these sort of moments in history where you do watch groups of people behave in this quote unquote very irrational way. And so you have social scientists come in and say, oh, well, they're under some sort of sociological hypnosis. And so let me articulate some vision of how that works.
Join the winner, no matter what their morality is.
Join the winner and find a way to make it make sense for you. You know, you have to change your values. You actually have to subjectively reorient yourself to reality so you can continue to be ontologically coherent. Like you really do have to readjust and to essentially go with the flow. So that looks like, oh, people have lost their minds. They've you know, changed so much. They've abandoned long held principles. But these are people acting under, you know, strict individual rationality to improve their prospects, their survival and reproduction prospects, just like we would anticipate. So, this kind of hand waving and very fancy sociological language is incorrect, somewhat misguided way of talking about that phenomenon.
It's interesting. This is where we get to fly our flag that evolutionary psychology has a unique precision in understanding this. For whatever good it might do, at least we understand that. I remember my friend Dr. Rick Seidel, you know, 20 years ago. Called me up and said, when we were talking about the differences between cognitive therapy and what it is that we do, he said, cognitive therapy assumes that people are, quote, irrational. And he says, the truth is they're totally rational.
Yeah, people are always rational.
They're always rational. All they do is they misunderstand, you know, features of reality. They misunderstand parameters, perhaps, but they're not irrational. So the people
you're only as rational as the information you're plugging into your computer to tell you what to do. So if your information is distorted and skewed and haywire, then you're going to have your calculator is going to come to a haywire result.
Yeah. What we're seeing worldwide is we're seeing this bizarre concept that that essentially they're. The end games, the thing is that led so many of my friends to be confused and disbelieving and sort of not, or certainly me too. I mean, I was there, God knows, in July. So I didn't start.
You were such a sweet little normie for such a long time. I was like, damn it, Doug, wake up.
Yeah. Well, it. You know, I needed to see the blatant disregard for all facts coming out of the CDC and subsequent our United States government, and that didn't happen until, you know, August and September. So, then we see all the dots on a line, and we realize that we're not seeing a picture where, you know, the head of Australia says this is ridiculous. What the hell are we doing with vaccine mandates? It don't make any sense at all. And then we're going to see the same thing in Canada, but then we don't see it in Germany. And we're like, okay, well, this is obviously politically motivated in Germany. Nope. We see wholesale disregard for the truth. Okay. For anybody that's interested, It's interesting that the Empire of Japan does not share the same opinion. Okay? So Japan does
very much going their own way.
They have no vax mandates. They actually explicitly tell people that there's to be no discrimination of any kind for people who are not vaccinated. Okay? So there's no vax passes to go into a restaurant. Why? Do you think that these people are irresponsible in terms of public health? Of course not. They have read the
quite
evidence.
The opposite.
No, yeah. They have read the evidence.
Even Russia, Russia has various tolerances in place, and you have I know there's at least a year of you get a year waiver from any vaccine mandate if you have natural immunity, if you can prove natural immunity. So the U.S. can't even go that far.
No,
we can't even get like a 6-month respite. You know, if you have a positive test, if you have an actual case of COVID, that gives you no exemption from any vaccine mandate, which is insane. So even Russia can manage that.
So understand that Russia doesn't have quite the same skin in the game as the United States, because the United States government is a target of the international cabal who wants to take over the machinery of the United States government in order to be in control of the world order. Russia is not going to cede control of the world order to that cabal. So as a result, they are in fact an independent agent that has possibly some utility for shoving their citizens around a little bit. As long as everybody's doing that, they might as well join a little bit. But they are actually not as absurd as the United States of America.
Yeah, so Mexico. There are countries, powerful countries scattered around the world that are. That's a really interesting combo: Japan, Russia, Mexico. Culturally super diverse, economically super diverse. You know, there's no one thing. You know, a comparative political scientist would be like, well, what do they have in common? What's keeping them out of the? You know, maybe not see an argument for that equivalently across all of them. But that is telling you that there is something more institutional and economic at work.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This is deep economics, and basically what we are concerned about and live in varying degrees of anxiety about is that you are watching the fact that a few people got wealthy enough that they could literally control world process. That's a very scary thing. We don't know where it's going, and we are aware that it's happening, and we're aware that the United States is the great prize. Okay, so yeah, whatever it is that you're trying to steal in the world, you know, there is one set of jewels that is the fanciest jewels that there are. The most important political system to get control of, and therefore you have control over the world, is the United States, and it is the hardest to take. Because we have the most sophisticated system of checks and balances, thank goodness, as a result of some deep thinking on the part of the forefathers. So we remain with greater freedoms than these other places that have already taken over by force their populations. These people in these other countries have not capitulated willingly. They are being forced to the point of a gun to do the bidding of this cabal. So this is the state of the world that we're in right now, and it would be remiss on a podcast to be talking about human happiness, decision-making, evolutionary biology, for God's sakes, and life, to not be noting that there is a large elephant in freedom's living room, and we're keeping our eye on it. And when we know anything or have anything particularly useful to comment on that we can think of, you'll be hearing from us. But we've been doing a lot of deep thinking. And right now, all we want to make sure that our people know, from the standpoint of us being transparent and as educationally useful as we can figure out how to be, is that there are big problems in front of us. There are also big, wise, strong, courageous people that are defending freedom in this country. And we salute those people. We support them. Robert Malone, Peter McCulloch. There's many other. Alex Berenson. There are a great many people that have done great work. Have done probably the greatest work of their lives. And so we hope. And I have I wouldn't say confidence, but I certainly have a lot of hope that there will be a lot of freedom left at the end of this. How much, I don't know, and I don't know what it's going to take to defend it. But that's where we are. Poor Jen is studied too much totalitarian regimes and is too less optimistic.
You just watch how easily, you know, democracies, how fragile they can be.
Yes.
The United States seems impervious and seems well consolidated, and it certainly is relative to the rest, but mm-hmm. it's not that old. It's only
right.
a couple generations old. It's not immune to these processes. And this is, as that essay that I sent you kind of points out, this is a very distinct, it's a stateless form of totalitarianism.
Yes.
Where it's really the elites versus everybody else, and the elites are cross-national, and that is really never happened before
right.
in human history. It's sort of like when we talk about totalitarianism, destruction of democracy, or just war in general, it's always oriented around the discussion of state versus state, and a kind of nationalism that is not present here. And so it's really it's difficult to wrap your head around it. It's a whole different language. It's a whole sets of assumptions that have to be let go, and whole new sets of assumptions that have to be absorbed, and it's a lot to process and to come to terms with, and from my perspective, a pretty demoralizing one.
Yeah.
Just because of my particular historical interest and what I'm familiar with. So
we're in the Super Bowl of freedom. They already beat all the weak teams. They beat Australia.
They beat Canada.
They beat New Zealand. They've beaten France. They're going to beat the UK easily, and the vote that I think the vote went down today. They have beaten Germany, and they have beaten Austria. Okay, so this is the Super Bowl of human freedom forever.
Canada.
They beat Canada easily. So the truth is that the one team that has a chance against global totalitarianism is the United States, and it's the strongest team. It has it has the most and the best players, and so we absolutely have a chance. But it is daunting, and it's a strange thing to be talking 6 decades into this lifetime and never having considered this possibility, that the extraordinary freedom that the forefathers carved out and made possible in the United States and spread throughout the world, that literally is in the balance right now. Okay, so it is literally on trial for its life, and so we will see. It's not like we're going to die if freedom dies in the way that we know it. We will survive, and we will adapt, and we will make the best of our lives. But the extraordinary thing that has been the freedom of the United States of America, that concept of self-governance by allowing to be governed by the consent of the governed, that degree of freedom and the extraordinary prosperity and potential of human happiness, the optimal set of circumstances under which happiness is to be created inside of human beings, that is a maximally free society of which we are the approximation of what is possible. It has now found, there has been an extraordinarily serpentine process by which a threat has emerged. I didn't see it coming. The vast majority of people in the world haven't seen it coming. This thing has quietly emerged under the revolution in technology in the last 25 years. And so it is upon us, and it is dangerous as hell, and it is evil to the core. And,
I mean, that is such the technological revolution is such an important component, because this would not have been possible. You can't, like, as you're describing, it's not as if people are being actively knocks in the middle of the night and disappeared in the middle of the night or thrown into gulags, because that's not necessary. It's not necessary to actually act with force against anybody, because you can make an individual home a gulag.
Yes.
you can isolate and manage your population in ways with data surveillance, and also with the possibility of remote work work that everybody has and all of these things that were not in place even 10 years ago. And so this kind of, you know, perfect crime, the perfect perpetual crisis for anybody who would want to execute these kinds of political and economic takeovers of the U.S. or elsewhere have really been facilitated by our dependence on technology and our attachment to it. And I mean, I've ranted about this before, but you could never have gotten away with, you know, long-term quarantine lockdown policies in a population that couldn't stay home that in order to make a living. And so you have run into this situation where it's just possible in new ways for people to be productive from home, and increasingly so as the metaverse comes online. Mm-hmm. and that makes the entire population just
what a
more
paradox.
Vulnerable to all of this. So it's a
our own
huge
ingenuity.
Yeah, it is
what's,
a paradox.
What's allowed
yeah.
this to happen.
Yeah. But and we're more susceptible. Like, not only are we giving away the data through all of our use of technology that makes us easier to manipulate and control, but we're also consuming all of this data that is very tailored to us specifically, and you know the state media of the U.S. and elsewhere. If people haven't listened already, I don't think it's in danger of being taken down off of Spotify, but probably it's going to be taken down everywhere else. But Dr. Mm-hmm. Peter McCullough is mm-hmm. on with Joe Rogan this week, and it's a 3-hour-long conversation where they go over. McCullough a couple of times says this is like grand rounds on Joe Rogan. He has such familiarity with the literature, and he just cites paper after paper, and he calls out the actual propaganda techniques of CNN and others who just repeated talking points that were outright lies mm-hmm. to manipulate and to create narratives that that essentially. It, from McCullough's perspective, suppressed early treatment in favor of pushing people to get the vaccines, sure. among many, many other things. Yeah. And so, like, all of this is like part and parcel with what we're talking about. The sort of the specifics of what they're talking about on that podcast are the machine in action, essentially, and how this crisis has been harvested and leveraged for greater population control and will continue to be so.
Yeah, and it's not, they aren't making it up as they go along. This was exquisitely planned. And this is not happening by accident, okay? And so this is when you understand how carefully this was planned and how ruthlessly and viciously it's planned, you realize, "Oh, wait a second. You know, this isn't a disagreement and this isn't a little bit of pharmacological profiteering. This is war." Okay? And they're coming after everybody's money. They're going to drain everybody's bank accounts. When I say that, there are ways to do that where you don't even understand that has happened. They can also move, which they are moving very as swiftly as possible towards a non-cash economy and an all-out digital economy, so that they can control every possibility of you transacting with anybody else in the world. They must be able to know about it, and they can have AI surveil it. And so as a result, if they disagree with you and they don't like you and they don't like what you say, they can shut you down, make it impossible for anybody to pay you, and impoverish you and into submission and into poverty. Okay.
Even if they just don't like you a little bit, they give you, you know, all of your loans suddenly have a way higher interest rate. All of your, like, it's just, it becomes harder and harder to get by. It's not as if you've been completely deplatformed and disappeared. Yep. You know, you're able to participate, but it's very much like the Chinese social credit system where you are... you're burdened with these extra costs of doing business, and you can't do business everywhere.
Right. Yeah. And this is people.
And we see demand for this. We see, I mean, just look on Twitter any given day and you see the sort of outrage and the demand for more draconian mandates and mm-hmm. you know, the evil unvaccinated who are bringing society down. And there's this sort of, this othering process that is going on that is key to this whole process and this whole just the whole scheme.
This is
that too is by design.
It's unbelievable. It's so big. It's like you wake up, you know, you walk on the beach and you turn your back and you turn around and there's an 80-foot tidal wave coming at you. It's like, holy, you'd have no idea that thing was coming. It's a tsunami coming from an earthquake that happened out in the middle of the Pacific and nobody told you about it. And there it is. And you're staring at it. And that's what this is the equivalent of. And so, you know, all we can do is we can, you know, you do what you can for yourself, but mainly we are observing carefully and trying to understand and with people that we talk to that are in very difficult circumstances that I talk to, you know, weekly. I'm talking to several people that are up against it in some very, very important mm-hmm. way, either here or me around too. The world. Okay.
Yeah, me too. And lots of people have everybody, major conflicts.
Tremendous. And so this is the biggest monster in the living room of our time. You have other personal issues, individual issues with relationships, health issues, financial issues that are, you know, et cetera, problems with your kid in school that they say is ADHD. There's 1,001 problems, but we got another, you know, we got a big, big monster sitting in each of our living rooms, and we're watching carefully and hoping for the best. So more to follow when it makes sense.
Wow.
We snuck a little hawk blocked into the Beat Your Jeans this week. That's basically what just happened.
Yeah, can't help it. Yeah.
Well, we didn't record one this week anyway, so we just bundled them.
Yay. Yeah. Everybody that's on Hawk Block probably listens here, so this is all fair.
I think so. Yeah.
All right, folks.
Yeah, maybe we'll have a Bitcoin now, special too. Cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
Crypto is overrated. we can have a whole discussion about that, but I'm very dubious. I'm very dubious about that being the all savior. Right.
Well, Dr. Hawk, you're just about to receive probably a bunch of emails once I release this because of saying that. There are quite a number of people
sure,
that I know.
I'm sure a bunch of people
watch the podcast who are very into the Bitcoin crypto.
No, I was. Sure. I was very into it for a while as well, but my sort of larger view of the forces at work here make me skeptical of its ability to avoid those pressures, the same pressures that we're talking about, the sort of global elite takeover, you know, has levers that attach to cryptocurrency as well. So I don't see it as being a completely independent way to avoid this whole problem.
Yeah,
maybe buys you a little time.
We'll have to hear more about that another time. Doctors, thank you so, so much. All right. Love it. Can't wait for the next current event episodes. So, yeah.
All right, Nathan.
Always good to have a little solidarity, at least.
All right.
All right, folks.
All right, as the sky darkens above us.
One last thing that I also said on the previous and the Living with Some Library talk that we did, which is that Robert Malone said something that was important that caught my eye, you know, about maybe a month ago. And he said, you know, this is dark times and we're in trouble. He says, but one of the things is that you're going to meet new people and you're going to find new kindred spirits and you will, and they, this is a period of life that, you know, this crisis will forge some connections in your life that would not have otherwise been forged. And so, you know, we don't want that, but it's going to happen. And that there's truth in that. And so even remotely, you know, people, even me learning about a Robert Malone and a Peter McCullough is inspiring and fills me with gratitude and admiration for people that are stepping up and doing their best. And there's going to be people that I'm going to meet along the way of this journey. We're nowhere near the end of this thing. And so we're going to observe a lot. We're going to, it's been super useful for me to have a Jen Hawk, you know, to talk things over with and to listen and to educate me on so many angles of this. It helps to have people that you can respect and that you can learn from and try to piece these things together as we try to get a map of our new reality so that we can make the best moves for ourselves and our families.
It reminds me of 20 years ago. This moment has stuck with me for this long. I was watching the election returns of the 2000 election, which at the time I was, you know, were this was just traumatizing to watch this like toss up, where people who don't remember, you know, all the networks called the election for Gore, and then they were like, wait a minute, you know, like new shit has come to light, and so the night was left as a question mark with Bush v. Gore, and so I was frantically flipping around. I was alone in my office. I was working at a nonprofit. I was frantically flipping around for channels for anybody that was still on talking about it after like Brokaw went to sleep and everybody else signed off. And so I found myself wherever Tucker Carlson was CNN. At that time. I think he at CNN? He wasn't on Fox yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd never seen him before. This was my introduction
with
to
the
Tucker
red
Carlson.
Bow tie.
He had his little bow tie. And and I remember clear as day, he said, well, you know, you never know what's going to happen. It's always darkest just before the dawn. And then there was this beat, and he said, of course, it's also always darkest just before it goes completely black.
There you go.
So that's kind of how I feel. It's I'm walking that edge.
Right. That's beautifully said. You got it.
Yeah, it's come full circle to Tucker 20 years ago. There you go.
You got it. All right, folks.
All right. Well, it's been illuminating.
All right.
All good, Nathan. So we'll see everybody in a couple weeks.
Have a good night,
you
guys.
Yep.
Thanks for listening.
All right.
If you like what you hear, subscribe. Bye. Write us a review or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourjeans.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.